Could you, you mentioned Cinderella's proactivity. Could you give me a couple of examples of it? Because I honestly didn't really see a lot of proactivity in her character.
Well, I think that we start with her in a family that's functioning and loving and supportive, and in a sense you see it created in as much she's brought into the death of the mother, so that's shared with her, I think the passing on of a kind of a generous outlook, I think, is important. We also see that when she, when faced with, you know, perhaps the latest extreme example of cruelty, which is the renaming of her, we see a moment where she, you know, she gets on that horse and she goes. I think a question anybody asks of a modern Cinderella, why doesn't she leave? Well, she may leave there. She certainly has a passionate response to it. And a passionate response to the prince that she encounters. But as she talks about later on, she stays there partly because she, in her view, at this point, she honors her mother and father, and that's a positive and proactive decision, I think, to stay there. And also, I think, we meet her reading a book, you know, the grown-up Cinderella. We see a house that's full of, you know, curiosity. There are curious minds at work. So I think she stays partly to try and understand it. I would say that's an example of proactivity. And by the time she talks to the stepmother and stays, I mean, the proactivity is the decision to stay in a way and say, why are you so cruel? A determination to ask and understand this rather than simply react against it. We try to play out the various, in rehearsal, we try to work out, what if the script was slightly different? How and when and under what circumstances might she leave? And I think we found interesting alternates to that, but the challenge was to try and keep her in the story, but somehow find the way to express a strength that made us believe, as we did going into it, that this was a Cinderella who ultimately we believed would be fine if a prince didn't come along, who was not searching for that, but was searching on one level, just was searching for how you can be happy. And in this case, how you can be happy once what was your happiness, your happy family, has been removed. So I think in those ways, I think that's how we go at it.
So there were a lot of iconic images in this film. What was your favorite one to tackle? Which one were you nervous about? You know, the dress, the slipper?
Well, all of those, but I felt very, very secure in the world of Sandy Powell and her amazing, you know, talent with the costumes and the determination to, you know, be very inventive about all of those things. So the kind of balance between, you know, finding this sort of classical approach, you know, for instance, this sounds like a sort of simplistic question, but there was a big question about what color is that dress? You know, does it stay blue? The original was blue. What kind of blue? Is it pink? Because the mother's dress is pink, and should it stay pink in order to honor her mother? How much do we want to see a pink dress for that amount of time in the ballroom sequence? And what, you know, what can we do with material? How can we, how magical can we make the material that is pink as opposed to blue or some other color? So those conversations were all had, and it just becomes a stage-by-stage kind of process. And you felt quite a pressure with the slippers because, you know, you've got ruby slippers and you've got other slippers in film history, and it was going to be a big moment. So Sandy's worked with Swarovski to find this kind of multifaceted thing, which also has a heaviness. It was incredibly heavy, the real thing, and a kind of... a very sort of multifaceted thing, I think, was really a stroke of genius. And when we saw it for the first time, it was very gasp-inducing when we saw the actual object on a plinth that she presented it on. So we took a long time to look at the big expectation moments, I guess Cinderella at the top of the stairs coming into the ball was a favorite moment of mine, or actually even just walking from the coach up the steps and into the palace. I think the sort of moments where she comes into her own.
Why Cinderella? Of all of the stories that you could choose to work on or turn into a live-action version, why Cinderella?
It specifically came my way, so it wasn't... for me, the surprise was being asked to do this specific one. Partly, I think people feel an incredible ownership of the story. I think it's very personal to a lot of people. I think that there's a there's a relationship to the underdog or the outsider or however we choose to categorize it that seems to represent us, our hopes and dreams and aspirations. And there was a chance to do that but sort of recalibrate them. So in the scene between the sisters and Cinderella, you know, Cinderella says, what about the prince? What do you think he'll be like? And they say, it doesn't matter what he's like, he's a prince. And anyway, all men are stupid. The idea of working out whether it's possible to, you know, present a Cinderella who may feel differently about that was, I think, important, break some of those kind of types. But I think the my just experience, even just making that ball scene across, you know, we had hundreds of extras, we had hundreds of crew people, and lots of people who'd sort of been there and done that, were very jaded in the film business, perhaps you might say, who were extremely moved by this image of somebody who gets their shot, who gets a chance to be happy, who gets their trip to the ball, you know, whether that's literal or an image. And so I think the chance for it to be involved in something as important to people, as symbolically important to people, as simple as it appears to be, was very enticing.
Is there ever any talk about telling the story from a different angle or someone else's perspective? Or did you always want to keep it classic?
For me, I mean, that's what Chris Weitz's screenplay had, and that's what I liked. I remember saying to Ali Shermer, our producer, at the beginning of the process, I said, I think my big idea here is to try to get out of the way. The story's been working for 2,500 years. There's a reason why that's happening. And my experience has been to try and let the work of great storytellers do as much work as possible and then try and amend and adjust as best you see fit from your own perspective. My experience, for instance, in Shakespeare, and I've done it a number of times, where you take a strong conceptual idea and you might move the story completely. You might make it very modern. I did a version of a play called Love's Labour's Lost as a kind of Hollywood musical, so shifted it by, you know, 350 years, and to some extent did tell it from a different kind of viewpoint. And I think a lot of people, they may not just like the film, but for a lot of people, the actual idea itself was confusing. It got in the way and felt reductive. It may have been just specific to that, but I have found, I certainly, you know, I know that they in developing this, they thought about whether she could be, you know, in modern, wherever it might be, Brooklyn or whatever, and indeed there's tons of evidence of modern Cinderella stories, you know, where gender has changed or time has changed, but I feel as though you get a chance to consider, provoke, and think differently if it's through a classical perspective. To give a specific example, in doing it this way, in putting Cinderella and the prince on horseback, even Stevens, the same level, in nature, in this ancient forest, I think kind of cleans it up. So I get to see more of the two of them. I get a sense of the feeling and the scene and the sort of primal relationship there than I might do, even if I came up with the most fantastic and brilliant modern touches by having them meet in a restaurant or, you know, on a bridge or on an aeroplane, all of which would be entirely legit as well. You could have, because the story is so flexible. It's just that I'm not as drawn to that myself. But I know, I'm sure, as Disney and other people pursue the idea of live action versions of fairy tales, that's an absolute, you know, open and regular invitation to see whether it can live that way, and the world of the Cinderella story is as much part of our culture as the actual telling of the real tale.
We have time for one last question.
What brought you to cast Richard Madden for Prince
Charles? I thought that he had a sort of apart from very blue eyes, he had very tight trousers, but that was another. They weren't his own trousers, so I shouldn't really. He had intelligence and wit and also he relished the idea of how you might sort of play a gentleman. You know, he didn't. He wasn't striving hard to be a certain modern kind of cool. You know, I think both these actors. I love the idea that they were prepared to be uncynical in the film. You know, and just sort of respond directly to each other, and that a gallantry, a courtship, the desire to woo, to serve, to listen, were things that he felt could be played very positively and would be very, very attractive, and that in a way, there was a natural disposition in the world of the piece that we presented for him to love her, you know, and that he was able to do that and not see that as suddenly rendering him the love interest. It was a very powerful thing to be somebody listening, looking, and reacting, and trying to with the screen time that he has. And I think it's very touching, the wonderful chemistry between them. And I think he was somebody I felt could do this thing we needed to do of having a man who earned Cinderella's respect and love. Didn't just get it because he had a big car. All right. Okay. Thanks very much.